you want to use?
I'm not sure double works.
I feel like I'm the comedy break in all of this, because I'm neither a sociologist nor a political scientist, and my talk is not an aggregate one. It's going to be about individual behaviors. And we intended the title as a bit of ambiguity, as sort of a semi-humorous title, but it ended up getting us in this particular session, so I'm not sure. It's maybe a cautionary tale about using the word financing to describe individual behaviors. I also want to note that this is not a how-to presentation. In spite of our 401ks, I really do not want to be known as advocating this as a method of improving our now limited retirement funds. And the genesis of this is kind of in two ways. One is a question that I get asked a lot when I'm in communities doing talks, and that is, cocaine is a relatively expensive substance, and homeless people are not noted for having a great deal of financial resources. So how exactly does a population that is marginalized economically find money to afford a relatively expensive drug? And that led me to kind of go back and look at the literature. And what you see is the focus on cocaine is, in one sense, because if you look at addiction and substance use in the homeless population, cocaine is has moved past alcohol to being the most frequent abused drug of choice. And so it is the most prevalent particular substance, and it is one that provides the most intriguing question. The second half of this dates back, I don't know if there are any younger researchers, but dates back to my dissertation, to a question that I asked very badly. And that was, I asked a dissertation on homeless service use, I asked, how often do you use drugs? And I was about halfway through the survey, and everyone had answered once. Now, in all the other, they're using polysubstances, they are clearly a drug-using and abusing population, and they're all saying once. So I broke through my grim doctoral student have to finish the dissertation facade and said, I can't do a regression analysis if everyone answers one. What does it mean? And someone said, well, I get paid once a week. I go and I use the drugs till my money is gone. I use once. And then when I get paid again, I use once again. And that's kind of the background of the thinking on this. The other reason for doing the study is there have been a number of people that have talked about economic involvement. But the problem is we talk about it from a psychiatric perspective. That is, how do people who have the diagnosis of abuse or dependence, how are they involved in economic markets? And that's not really a financing question, because we don't know, even if they are recent, even if their diagnosis is current, there is always a temporal discontinuity. We know that they meet current diagnosis because they've been exhibiting symptoms in the last year, and we know where they say we're earning money, but we can't really say that these two things are happening at the same time. And so what this is really taking this particular area and trying to get at the financing question very directly by looking contiguously at what people who are currently using, as tested using urine screening, are doing within the same time period, within the past 30 days, so that we can make the assumption that if they are using, they are paying for it with money that is happening at the moment. And that's really what we're doing, is kind of taking this question and asking it in a way that's slightly more precise from a financing. And what we're doing is we're taking advantage of a NIDA-funded study where we did a population sample of 400 that is recruited randomly across shelter and time and in street locations, and had three interviews where we did, basically we asked them everything we could possibly think of. This is a very traditional services epidemiology study. And so we have behavior across time, a population sample. And one of the things you have to do if you do homelessness research is you have to walk people through your attrition so that you know who's in the analysis. Because we started with 400. We had the ones to kind of point out is we had 255 where we have complete data. That is, we have all of the interviews at each of the time points and all of the urine samples. And the nice thing is we've used this number in a couple of other papers. We've tried very hard to make sure that, to look at all the possible ways that attrition may have impacted on the sample, and we really don't have any statistically significant differences in terms of descriptive use at baseline, et cetera. So rather than doing a fancy imputation or something like that, we've elected to kind of go with the folks we have complete sample. The other thing this does in a complete sample is this allows us 3 points in time, where we have urine screens at 3 points in time and financing at 3 points in time. So we can capture folks. If you've done urine screening, and given that you're attending this session, probably very few of you are doing kind of individual level epidemiology. I may be making a mistake, but that's what it reads from looking at everyone else's abstracts, is you know that urine samples have a very short lifespan. So you're talking somewhere between 48 and 72 hours, depending on the substance screened. And so if they test positive, they're using then, which is also kind of interesting because they know they're going to be screened on a urine sample. So you know that this is definitely at the moment. But having multiple opportunities, we capture more. I do want to say one thing about what I'm going to present in terms of analyses, because there were two options. We've done them both ways, but I'm going to present the simpler, and that is pairing up individuals who are positive with their time for each time and then doing an analysis where we control for intercase, or just kind of lumping them all together. We've done them both ways. The findings are fundamentally the same, and because we have 12 minutes, I'm going to present the aggregate rather than the broken down by year. But the correct analysis is really who used and what were they doing at each time period. So we're presenting a simpler one. And basically all we're looking at is, did they participate in the activity, and where they could give estimates, how many dollars did they earn in the previous month. We looked at five categories of income-generating activities: employment, entitlements, both welfare and disability, whether they participated in illegal activities, and this could be anything from, well, pretty much anything, but most frequently when we probed, we were talking about mostly involvement in the drug market, and panhandling, which at the time of the study was technically not, it was illegal but not enforced in St. Louis. And then basically what I'm going to present is an analysis of differences in dollars by income source, looking at gender differences, because historically the research says that men and women who are homeless generate income from different sources, and then a little bit of modeling where we put it all together to try and tell the story. So just a quick look at the demographics. It's, as is the case in most cities and has been in St. Louis, this is probably a sample that doesn't look particularly surprising. It's primarily male. St. Louis, it's primarily African American. It's disproportionate to population, but the city of St. Louis is over 50% African American, so it is disproportionate, but maybe not as disproportionate as it might be in a city that is less biracial. It is younger. I will say it went from an older sample to a younger sample from 10 years ago when we started the study to today. I think that's a projection for any clinicians out there. If you're younger than the sample, it's older. If you're older than the sample, it's younger. I'm getting some smiles, mostly from people I would guess are older. It is what we would call a more chronic population, with an average of almost 4 years and a median of 3 years of homelessness. So it is a more of a chronic population than not. And just to kind of give you some basics on, the other thing is the diagnoses fall out about where you would expect. Around 60% have abuse or dependence. lifetime, slightly less during the year, about a third mental illness with depression as the primary, and comorbidity is, from a mental health perspective, is around 92%. So the persons with mental illness have a comorbid addiction. In terms of sources of income, the two driving it most are welfare, which is defined very broadly, which is any governmental support program that's not disability, and employment, although most of the employment is part-time and almost all of it is unskilled. And then smaller percentages, and these are, one thing to keep in mind is these are, did they do receive income from these sources in the previous 30 days, not did they receive income ever. So the numbers look slightly lower. And across all time periods, at the first interview, 1 in 5 tested positive, and around 40% tested positive at least once. So when you look at this, in one sense, it's the non-income, the thing that was interesting to me here is that neither panhandling nor illegal market involvement was statistically different in terms of dollars per month. Employment was significantly higher if you tested positive for use, and entitlements higher if you tested negative. Not surprisingly, again, from the literature, the men tended to be more likely to have positive tests than women. Research, longitudinal research, suggests that women are catching up with men in terms of cocaine use, but they're not there yet. Women are more likely to receive from income, and the proportions from other sources are not statistically significant. So now we begin to put it all together, and some things change as we put the variables together, and that is probably the most important variable is indeed gender, which is not a major surprise. But instead of entitlement, what pops out when you control for gender is that the illegal incomes then become associated with testing positive. So if you are if you report panhandling in the previous 30 days, you're more than twice as likely to have a positive drug test. If you are participating in other illegal market, primarily drug market, you're 3 times as likely. So basically, as you look at the story, financing drug use really appears to be, if anything, a story of using the market itself to finance the use. And so what we're seeing then in homeless, in answer to the question of how do you finance cocaine use, it is that primarily you are working in non-legitimate markets, and likely, although we can't do this analysis with any precision, it is likely that you're financing by participating in itself. And that entitlement differences, as much as they come up in the bivariate, really are more about gender than cocaine use. Now, I want to finish by kind of highlighting a couple of pieces that are not in this analysis. I started by saying this is a use study, not a disorder study. So we didn't analyze how the use relates to abuse or dependence. So it's quite possible that some of our users are not addicted. And so that this is where the story is a little different than the literature. We only looked at cocaine. We will be obviously pursuing this with other substances, particularly we think the opiate users, which is the other class that we have some curiosity about. And we didn't look at non-substance abuse comorbid disorders. And the next step for us is obviously going to be looking at individuals. Do they use or not use, and does that change their financial involvement? We would hypothesize, kind of based on the story I've told, that they would. Thank you.